Again, I'm here with Miguel Nunez and Marika Virgin of the Louisiana Defenders Collective. Thanks so much for coming on today.
Thank you. Good morning. Thank you for having us on.
Yeah. So I guess just to start, what is the Louisiana Defenders Collective? How did you guys get started and what are you trying to do?
Well, Louisiana Defenders Collective is a group of attorneys, investigators, and legal representatives dedicated to outstanding representation of people accused of a crime here in Louisiana. We provide legal representation for a variety of circumstances, including criminal indictments, probable cause hearings, bonds, you know, trials, dispositions, post-convictions, appeals, parole hearings, and even sentencing modifications. We specialize in criminal adult hearings, juvenile delinquency cases, juvenile adult transfers, and juveniles who receive life without parole. And what we're offering the community is an experienced, dedicated team whose work ethic has produced favorable outcomes for numerous clients here in New Orleans and Louisiana. We offer reasonable rates, as a lack of resources should never create a barrier to adequate equal representation when your life and freedom are at risk. And, you know, we just want everybody listening to know that we would love the opportunity to serve your legal needs, earn your trust in business. So if you find yourself needing legal services, which you know, many people do, you know, it's a fact of a matter that you know, you can get pulled over or stopped and arrested and face, you know, criminal prosecution here. And so we want to let the community know that we formed this collective together because we see a need for adequate legal services here in this city and a hole that's missing where people can actually afford to be able to hire a team of legal representatives and professionals. And that's the hole that we're trying to fill. We formed the Defenders Collective, and we're treating this as such, as whereas you come and pay, you know, you come in and pay for our services and you're getting a whole legal team, not just one attorney or two attorneys, but you're getting attorneys, investigators, advocates that can be able to serve your needs holistically. And that's what we're trying to fulfill. So if anybody needs legal services, again, our number is 504-645-0796. I just wanted to get that phone number out there because, you know, we hear a lot of things on the radio like, oh, well, how do I get in touch with you? So I wanted to put that out there. But that's basically who we are, what we're trying to do, why we're doing what we're trying to do, and what we hope to accomplish.
So you talked about there being a hole in the system. So what hole did you see, or what kind of experience have you had that made you feel like there was something missing?
Well, I think from my perspective in being a legal professional for over 10 years, part of my experience has been in a public defender's office in the public defender system. And of course, when you have been ruled by the court to be indigent, the court appoints an attorney for you. However, there are people that don't meet that indigency requirement. And also, you know, these people to me are falling limbo because you don't qualify them to receive a public defender, but you don't have O.J. Simpson type money either, where you can go out and hire the dream team and, you know, all that type of stuff, 10 attorneys and 15 investigators and forensic experts and all that type of stuff. So there to me lies a need for people to be able to access adequate representation for their criminal cases. Where, you know, they're not rich. We're not talking about rich folks. They can go out and hire, you know, some big names around here and stuff. But so who do those people that don't get a public defender, what do they do? And oftentimes community members that receive criminal indictments and catch cases, and even the parents of juveniles who are being locked up and face prosecution, you know, they're having to do everything they can to try to raise up money to hire, you know, an attorney when they don't. When they're not ruled indigent and get assigned a public defender. I mean, folks are doing fish fries, whatever, you know, house parties, all that type of stuff to be able to pay folks. And, you know, as I said in the beginning, you know, financial barriers shouldn't stop you from receiving adequate legal representation, because if you don't make a certain amount of money, you're guaranteed legal representation under the United States Constitution.
Yeah, I would just add that we're pretty new as a collective, but one of our most recent case that we had together, we were able to work and help a client secure a case that was dismissed. But what I think probably the biggest victory was in that case was that it was a person who kind of fell into one of those holes that Miguel was mentioning, where there was some amount of money there to higher representation, but he was having a really hard time finding an attorney that was affordable that would even talk to him for, you know, short of thousands of dollars. So another thing is that we offer free consultations locally, so there would never be, you know, any money, at least here in town, that anyone would have to put down just to be able to communicate with a lawyer and to talk to us and to, that's something we feel pretty strongly about. And so that's definitely, and I think that that client helped us realize that there are a number of people who fall into that category who have been told by judges that, you know, for whatever reason, you might have this amount of money, but you need to hire a lawyer. So that's one hole. Mm-hmm. I think there are some others also.
A lot of times, that's huge, just being able to, like, you know, create a payment plan, in other words, because a lot of folks don't have cash lying around waiting for a criminal charge to happen to them. So, you know, being able to have a reasonable rate. You know, of course, we can't work for free. Unfortunately, you know, this is how we make a living too. You know, we're just like a doctor or a mechanic or anything else. You know, we provide a certain skill set that people need in order to be able to receive adequate representation when they're dealing with a criminal case. I would say one of the other things that defines us is that we're very client directed. You know, with us, the client is the boss. You know, we're your legal, you know, we're trying to be your legal advisors. We want to give you our years of experience, based on the facts, and every case is different, how we think the case is going to go, what we can provide in terms of theory of defense, what reasonable doubt that we can uncover, what witnesses are going to come to court and actually testify to. You know, actually proving that, you know, can the prosecution's theory that you committed this crime actually be proven? You know, those are all skill sets, preparing the motions, preparing a theory of defense and actually arguing that theory of defense and showing the court that reasonable doubt does exist in this case. And according to our legal system, if you can show that reasonable doubt exists, even if it's a small percentage, then you cannot return a verdict of guilty. And that's our constitutional rights that we enjoy. And I can't remember the person, but it was some famous person in history that said, I'd rather let 100 guilty people go free rather than have one innocent person locked up. And I might be quoting that wrong. But we've seen our criminal justice system, the landscape, change, you know, over the course of the years to going through where it used to be beyond a shadow of a doubt. That was the legal burden. Beyond the shadow of a doubt, and now it's kind of come down to reasonable doubt. And now, you know, starting in the 80s and 90s, we started going through mass incarceration, you know, get tough, two strikes and you're out in some states. You know, you didn't even get three strikes. It was two strikes and you're out. Those type of situations created mass incarceration on a scale to where we're number one in the world in terms of incarceration per capita. And in Louisiana, is the state that has the highest rate per capita of incarceration in the United States. So that means us here in Louisiana are number one in the world for incarcerating and locking up people. Sometimes the punishment that's meted out doesn't fit the circumstances that exist. And sometimes, you know, people are picked up, misidentifications happen, you know. And what we've come across is just because, for instance, a witness that might be sure in their mind that this is the person that actually did it, just because they're resembling self-assurance that they're sure doesn't actually equal fact. And I think that's the thing that there's a lot of misgivings that we have because, again, in my opinion, we're bombarded with the police officer shows, the law and order. Criminal intent, special victims unit, CSI, all of those type of things, and we expect that that's how things happen in actuality, and a lot of times that's just not the case. So, unfortunately, there's not a lot of movies made about, you know, defense attorneys working for, you know, people that are, you know, working poor or lower middle class or something like that. You know, if you do see a defense attorney show on TV, it's The Practice or something like that, where there's these high-priced, you know, attorneys working for very powerful, rich business owners and people and things like that. You know, there's no shows about the lowly defense attorney trying to, you know, represent people's rights. And definitely not any type of defense investigator shows. Like, people don't even know defense investigators exist, hardly. And we do.
We're both investigators, actually.
Yes.
We work with lawyers in the collective. We're also part of the collective, but Miguel and I both are experiences as investigators.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So you guys also said that you specialize in juvenile cases, and I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about your experience with juvenile, like how juveniles are treated in the system here in New Orleans.
Yeah, both Miguel and I also come out of years of experience at the Juvenile Public Defender's Office here in town. So that was another thing that I wanted to just add what Miguel was saying earlier about the hole that we fill. Not only do I think we provide an affordable option for people that is much needed, but we also have much more experience actually with trials and as line defenders, defending people in court. There are plenty of good lawyers out there, but I think we also provide more than adequate representation. We actually provide a lot of experience and so, you know, good representation at affordable rates.
So
if maybe you want to talk more about kids.
Yeah, right now, you know, our team has probably over a decade of experience dealing with juvenile cases. So, you know, I worked for almost 4 years in the Juvenile Defender's Office in Marietta as well. What that allowed us to do is come in contact with a high volume in a number of cases. Like for instance, there's only two investigators, you know, that were for the office. So if a child that was 16 years old or younger was charged with a crime in New Orleans, then one of those two investigators had a 50% chance of receiving their case to investigate. What we have found here in New Orleans, and of course this landscape has changed over the years, and especially since after Hurricane Katrina, we went from being in Orleans Indigent Defender Program, which is what existed before, into Orleans Public Defender, and more than just the name changed, of course. Back before Hurricane Katrina, defense lawyers could be, they could have their own private practice as well as working for the Public Defender's Office. Our juvenile court was in a state of how a lot of systems were before Katrina, and Katrina in a lot of ways was uncovered or unlifted the veil on what was happening to poor, mostly black people here in the city in New Orleans. We started, we kind of helped lay the groundwork for the Juvenile Defender's Office, and at that time, was the only standalone Juvenile Defender's Office in the country. What we're seeing now, even with the reforms and, being almost 10 years after Katrina, is, I think the juveniles are first of all, we have a hypertension sense of what juveniles are here in this city, because we see these sometimes horrific circumstances, murders that happen, and we get a perception that, all these juveniles are just running around, wild, buck wild out here and stuff. And in reality, there's probably, at least when I was, the time that I was there, there was maybe about less than 1,500 petitions for the entire year. So that means maybe 1,500 cases were happening, and that wasn't all just different individuals either. The point is we don't hear the good stories about juveniles. When they're doing good, when they're making the straight A's, or they're excelling, or they're winning a spelling bee or something like that. We hear on the news about when the bad stuff happens. And so first of all, I think our framework is a little skewed on that, and that comes down to when you're talking about the purpose of incarcerating juveniles, and the only purpose to incarcerate a juvenile is for the purposes of rehabilitation. So it's a little bit different than adult court. Adult court, the theory is, you're being punished. You do the crime, you do the time. Whereas in juvenile court, everything related to a juvenile sentence is supposed to be related towards rehabilitation. Like, hey, look, we see you going off track, you're going off path, you're catching these delinquent charges, you're being delinquent out here. We want to stop you and intervene and save you before you go off into the adult prison system. Of course, here in Louisiana, is 17 years old. You could be off in Angola somewhere at that point. So the treatment is supposed to be related towards rehabilitation for the juvenile. And what we found, oftentimes, is, especially before Katrina and even after Katrina moving forward, is sometimes it just does become about punishment. And what we did that was different was provide holistic wraparound representation services. So even, you know, while our child was waiting to go to trial for whatever charge he was charged with, in the meantime, we're out, you know, filing motions. We're out investigating the case. We're out, you know, if the child is not in school, trying to get them back enrolled in school. We're out trying to find programs and services that exist in the community that will be able to service whatever those needs of that child is going through and be able to access the network that exists for help here in the city. So we're doing all of that at the same time as we're working on the legal case because and oftentimes we have to work with the families because sometimes to solve the child's problem, you have to solve the family's problem, like homelessness, for example. You know, we've had homeless clients before. And so if you're ordered to be inside a curfew at 7 p.m., but you have nowhere to be inside at, well, that becomes kind of hard to follow a judicial order, as you can imagine. So anyway, we have that type of experience. And so that's the kind of, you know, the landscape of where we are now is we've come a long way in terms of reforms back from before Katrina and the Tallulahs from back in the days when that juvenile prison was closed down. You know, at that time there was maybe roughly over 2,000 juveniles locked up across the state. We're down into the hundreds now. Instead of that, there's reform systems like the Missouri model that everybody touts and is attempted to be followed here in Louisiana, but we still have a ways to go. Juveniles are definitely still being disproportionately racially, you know, incarcerated here in the city. We're still trying to figure out alternatives to detention instead of just locking up juveniles. Is there a better placement while they're waiting to go to trial? If the juvenile doesn't pose a risk to public safety, and there's no, you know, the child is going to keep returning back to court, then why are you locking them up? And so some of the things that we're still facing with and people are faced with needing adequate representation to walk through that if they don't get assigned a juvenile defender. They need a team that's going to be able to navigate through all of that stuff. The case it is in juvenile court and all the processes and hearings and things leading up to a trial, if need be, and even the service after that, and even the post dispositional services. So it's a lot involved in it that we're very specialized in because we've done it and we've done it at a high volume, very quickly. Because that's in juvenile court, cases move very quickly, quicker than adult court. So
I think you were talking about the collective also, but definitely those sort of wraparound services and things like that are something that a holistic defense model is something that we bring, that we have experience doing and that we bring to the collective as well. As far as talking about juvenile defense or juvenile justice here in the city in general, there's so many things I could say about our experience doing that, but I think the one thing that I can't not say when there's a microphone in front of me is just to try to highlight the large number, the high number of kids who are disappearing into the adult system, oftentimes on their first arrest, that I think is something that we sort of skip over when we talk about juvenile justice, and is something that I want to, I mean, it's so invisible. They're just a high number of kids who are maybe 15 or 16 who come in as technically juveniles, but who are charged with a certain crime right from the jump. Many, many, many on their first arrest who never have a shot of a sentence or many hearings in juvenile court and are brought right away to OPP and often get a high number of years right on their first charge sometimes, and that's something that sort of escapes a lot of juvenile statistics, and something also that those transfer cases from juvenile to adult court is something that Miguel and I and some others on the collective have a lot of experience in dealing with, and there's a lot at stake in those cases, and so that's something I would just want to say that we want to be there for and have experience with.
Yeah, can you explain that more? Like, you were saying at 17 you were considered an adult, but there's, like, what's the leeway within the system? Like, they can say, okay, you're gonna be charged an adult now, even if you're younger than 17, or how does that work?
Exactly. So if you're 17 or older, there's no question you're in the adult court system. However, if you're 15 or 16 years old and you get charged with a serious crime, and so there's a number of them, but of course, murder, attempted murder, armed robbery, aggravated rape. Some of those type of charges, then the district attorney's office here in Orleans Parish has the option to either leave your case in juvenile court or transfer your case to adult court and have those proceedings up there. And so you can imagine, the number, I cannot personally remember one case at the time the district attorney did not transfer to adult court. If the juvenile was 15 or 16 years old, they're automatically almost going up.
Some are almost automatic or are automatic, and with some there's a window for advocacy to keep a 15 or 16 year old or 14 in some cases in juvenile court as opposed to an adult court. So that's it's a small window, but it's a really important one for advocacy and for.
So those are the 15 to 16 year olds. But even if you're 14 years old, if you're a 14 year old and you're charged with armed robbery, you can be transferred, to adult court. Now, you think, oh, armed robbery, a gun, all that type of stuff. But actually, I'm in the radio studio, so you can't see what I'm doing. But I could take my finger and hold it up under my shirt and point it at you. If you, the person, feel that you actually have a weapon or a gun being pointed at you and that you're reasonably in fear for your life and I demand something from you and you give me your wallet or your purse or something, that constitutes as armed robbery. So at 14 years old, the district attorney's office could put on a special hearing for 14-year-olds to prove that you're irrestorable. You're never going to be rehabilitated ever again in your life, and therefore we need to transfer your case to adult court. Those type of hearings for 14-year-olds are a little bit more rare because the burden to prove that a 14-year-old is irrestorable at that age is kind of hard. You don't know what this 14-year-old is going to be. Maybe if they have the chance and an opportunity and a hope of their life getting better, then they might not just end up a criminal for the rest of their life. And to be honest with you, there's not much difference between a 14-year-old and a 15-year-old. But the 15-year-old doesn't get the benefit of that special hearing. They just automatically get transferred to adult court. And there's not really much difference between a 15 and 16-year-old and a 17-year-old. But that 17-year-old mm-hmm. is automatically, in the adult system. And so, and from our perspective, we have locked up so many people for so long that we keep dipping down into the age brackets. More and more, we've exhausted the 30-year-olds and the 20-year-olds, and now we're working on we've exhausted even the 18 and the 17-year-olds, and now we're working on the 16 and 15, and now even 14-year-olds, to feed what started as a private prison industry. Back before Hurricane Katrina, back in the 90s, there were two private prison corporations here in Louisiana that were operating with housing juveniles. You think about it in the adult prison industry, because we do have adult private prisons here in Louisiana. But I guess people didn't back then at least look and see like it's happening with the juveniles, and that's what brought conditions so worse in Tallulah, like where juveniles were getting beat down, raped, even from the prison the correctional officers, and which forced the federal government to close it down. And there was a lot of local work that went into that, happening from people like, organizations like JJPL, local juvenile court, Judge Mark Doherty, people like that were instrumental in helping. And even the JRS, which is Juvenile Regional Services at the time, came up out of JJPL in that struggle and battle to try to reform the juvenile justice system, which was probably one of the worst, in the country at the time. Just to put out there, we do offer those type of specialized services, the juvenile transfer hearings, and it's happening, more and more frequently that we don't like to say. I would say there's probably, and this is an estimate, at least this was the case at the time I was there, 60 to 70 juvenile transfer cases per year. So that's 60 or 70 juveniles that are automatically being going into the adult system that could face life. Fortunately, with the Graham and Miller cases, now it's become unconstitutional to give a juvenile life without parole. One of the other areas that we specialize in is starting to deal with the some of the Miller cases. And there's probably about 300 and or so Miller clients that are here in Louisiana. And that means this was a juvenile that received life without the possibility of parole back when they were a juvenile, 15, 16 years old. Right. And now a lot of these clients now, they're older now. They're 30, 40, 50, in some cases 60 years old that were locked up when they were juveniles. And so now, you know, there's an opportunity to try to petition and see, you know, can we do something on your case? Can we make an argument for now if, you know, do you receive the right to receive parole? And I think that's what's still being decided now in terms of the Supreme Court. The big push now is that retroactive? Does that mean that this person here that was convicted back in 1984 as a juvenile and received life without parole, do they have the right now to petition the court for the possibility of parole? Or did that Supreme Court decision just mean that from this day forward, you cannot lock up a juvenile and give them life without the possibility of parole? In some of these cases, now you think, you know, these are the heinous cases or these are the murder cases and the, you know, real bad facts and circumstances. And a lot of the cases are, there's bad sets of circumstances that happen and exist. But that doesn't mean that everybody's culpable. For instance, here in Louisiana, if you're in the car and your friend that you're riding with gets out and goes and shoots somebody half a block and runs back to your car, gets in and say, man, go. You know, you could be charged as a principal, just like you pulled the trigger yourself and shot and killed somebody. And in some of these juvenile cases, that's the case. You know, these were juveniles that were hanging around somebody else and an incident happened and they ended up getting charged. So, like I said, every case is different. It takes a specialized team to be able to walk through this. Especially these juvenile cases, a lot, you know, again, we're highly specialized because there's not a whole lot of people around, you know, the city, the state, the country that deal in juvenile defense. Another difference about juvenile court is you don't get a jury trial. You know, the judge is the one that decides your case. You don't have the benefit of a jury, and that's some of the constitutional separations between juvenile court and adult court. And again, the reason being, when you're a juvenile, every sentence you receive is supposed to be related towards rehabilitation and not punishment.
Yeah, I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about, I mean, both of you talked about you had experience in the juvenile defender's office, and I'm just curious, like, what motivated you to make the transition into this and how you feel the systems are working now. I mean, I know there's a new facility that's being constructed and that kind of stuff.
Well, I'll go first. I think just like with everybody that's been a frontline defender for a number of years, the work can weigh on you, and it can weigh on you considerably. So for instance, from my perspective, being an investigator, I get to see how crime affects all the parties involved. So I have to go out and talk to victims and complainants of crimes, and you know, sometimes bad things happen to people. This very hard for them to talk about. You know, you can imagine a rape. For instance, you know, when a woman has been raped and violated to that extent, it's very hard sometimes to be able to talk about those circumstances and what did the person look like and having to relive that whole moment. And so we as investigators, we experience that. We experience the impacts of how crime affects the defendant, the hardships that they're going through. and you know, especially when there's a real serious question of innocence, like this person wasn't even, might not even been here, the effects of the families of the victims and complainants, the families of the defendants, and the community is large. When a house gets broken into, you know, the person themselves feel the impact of that, but also the neighbors that are around those houses that we're going out and talking to as potential witnesses, you know, they feel the impact of that. So I think is me working in the defender's office and having a high volume and amount of cases and seeing all of the things that happen and exist with people within our city, we see it from all sides. In other words, and we're having to process that and still try to do our job, still try to, you know, be as effective as we possibly can. You know, we empathize with a lot of people and circumstances that happen to folks, but, there are a lot of times where, the investigation is just not properly done. There's reasonable doubt that this person even did it or was even out there. You know, sometimes we'll find evidence and sometimes video proof evidence that this person was over here 2 miles away from where this incident happened. So it couldn't have been this person that did it. But sometimes people can give false information, accuse, individuals of being there. Even serious crimes such as a murder case. You know, I've had a murder case one time where some anonymous informant said such and such did it. And such and such was actually picked up, arrested, and charged with a murder based off somebody's false information. Luckily, we stopped it before, and this was a juvenile and it got transferred to adult court, and luckily we stopped it before they actually got formally indicted in the adult system because we provided so much evidence to say that this person was over here, you know, way far away from where the incident happened at. And so those type of things will weigh on you, but you also see areas that could be improved, areas where we could do things better, areas where the holes that exist, like what I'm talking about, where people that you know really can't afford a private attorney, but they make more money and don't qualify, you know, for the public defender's mm-hmm. office, and we saw that whole the gap in that hole so much. And there's also other gaps like conflict cases. You know, the public defender's office cannot handle, for instance, let's say, three defendants are charged with the same crime. Well, the public defender's office can only handle one of those clients. The other two individuals have to have conflict attorneys.
May still be indigent.
Yeah, they may still be indigent, but they have to have conflict panel attorneys. And so in juvenile court, there's a conflict panel attorney list. In adult court, our public defender system here in New Orleans provides its own in-house conflict panel. But if you have three defendants, you still need another conflict attorney or four defendants. Sometimes there's five defendants. Right now, we're seeing multi-bill indictments, charges where, multiple 20, 30, defendants on a big conspiracy or racketeering state case, RICO, state RICO case or something like that is going on. So there's areas, where, that's the hole that we saw that we're trying to fill. So as we've moved on and transitioned from the juvenile defender's office, as we gain experience, as we take on handling these cases, that's what we're trying to provide. We're state licensed investigators. We're Louisiana barred and licensed attorneys. We have over 3 years of, three decades of collective experience dealing with just criminal law. So we don't do wills and testaments. We don't close on your house for you or anything like that. We deal specifically with criminal defense, which is in its own specialized field. There's not a lot of specialized defense attorneys that are out here because frankly, If you're in law, if you're coming out of law school and you probably have a lot of student loans and debt and things like that, and you have to figure out a way how to pay for that. There's some loan forgiveness if you go into public interest law, of course, but there's also, attorneys being faced with and also legal professionals, investigators as well, and advocates. How do I repay all of this debt? And oftentimes you do other parts of the law. You specialize in maybe corporate law or being a tax attorney or a civil attorney and filing lawsuits, where there's money to be made at. A lot of times, people that need our services can't afford our services a lot, and therefore a lot of attorneys don't choose to go into criminal defense. But I mean, it's something that's really, really, really overlooked. It's one of our constitutional guarantees. That's what's supposed to separate, you know, our country from a lot, some of the other countries around the world, is because we have a legal system where you're presumed innocent until proven guilty. And a lot of times it just doesn't work like that. You're guilty and you have to prove yourself innocent. And that's how it's really going down. So
I think for me, a few things, or for us, a few things definitely influenced that decision. One of them, a big one, is, yeah, just a desire to take the experience that we had and spread it to those holes. Even though public defenders come out of a pretty horrible legacy, I think a lot of the public defenders in town, even right now, are still some of the best lawyers. They're the best people to take a criminal case, to take a defense case, and we come out of that experience. And so just wanting to spread that to other places. And another thing was just wanting to, yeah, seeing areas for improvement in ourselves and wanting to direct ourselves and to work together the way that we're deciding to work together, which I know is another thing we wanted to talk about a little bit if we have time, but just as a collective. So we are all a team, the lawyers and investigators and advocates all together, and we're working, you know, side by side as opposed to hierarchically. And I think that affects how we work with clients in a number of ways, and I think that it's something that's pretty beneficial to the client-attorney relationship. Mm. So that's another thing that we're able to do.
Definitely. And so when you see in our name, Louisiana Defenders Collective, when you see that word collective, you know, what that means is that we've established an equal working relationship with each other. And so in some settings, you know, the attorney is looked at as being the, you know, the holier than thou or something like that. And we don't have that type of relationship in our collective. An attorney has a certain skill set that allows them to litigate your case in the court and to advocate for you and to stand up for you. And the investigator, for example, has another skill set that is going out and visiting with witnesses, visiting with victims and complainants, going out and searching for reasonable doubt. Those are two different skill sets, and those two skill sets complement each other, and both of those skill sets are really required and needed to be able to adequately represent your client. Now, of course, the attorney is you know, handles dealing with legal strategies, with putting on the best theory of defense and trying to compile all the pieces that attorney needs to successfully argue and advocate for you inside of a courtroom. And in order to gather some of those pieces that the attorney needs, they utilize investigators, advocates, whatever is needed to be able to get that job done for that client. Sometimes it's calling on expert witnesses. So the attorney is almost like the coordinator of all these pieces of a moving, successful defense. And so, you know, we're a part of that, but we decided that we wanted to be equal because our jobs are no more important or less important than another one. Some of the stuff that we as investigators go out there and find can help the attorney prove that there's reasonable doubt here and that it exists. And, you know, because like I said before, there's not a lot of movies or TV shows about us. Some people don't know they exist or even know to, you know, to ask, for instance, for an investigator. So an attorney can't be a witness for themselves. So if an attorney goes out and talks with a witness and gets a good piece of information, and that witness comes to court and they act like, no, I didn't tell you anything like that at all. An attorney can't put themselves on the stand as their own witness and impeach that person with. And therefore, you need somebody else to go out and talk with witnesses and things like that and try to gather the facts of the case. And so the collective also implies that we're dealing, you know, we're starting to deal with a number of attorneys, a number of specialized attorneys that we want to create a collective from. So when you come to the collective, you can be able to access what type of attorney, what type of legal representation, what type of legal service that you need. Because sometimes, it might not entail going all the way to a trial or litigation at court or things like that. We hope in the future to really open up and provide reasonable rates, adequate services, excellent legal representation for a number of fields and varieties. You know, because we're coming out of criminal defense background, you know, that's what we can offer right now. That's what we're specializing in. But we hope to branch out and really become a community law office. And what I mean is whatever problem a community member has or a neighbor has, they can walk into our office and be like, hey, this is what's going on. Or they can call us and we'll come over. That's maybe another thing that separates us. You don't have to come to our office. We can come to you. We come to your house. We believe we're big in visiting with people, you know, meeting them where they feel comfortable at. So we're not going to be, you know, stuck in the office all day long and stuff. We like to be out. We live here in New Orleans. You know, we're in the community. We're from the community where some of our clients, you know, are. We're very accessible. You know, if you pick up the phone and call us, we're going to answer. If you email us, we're going to email you back. You know, we're going to keep you, you know, in the loop of what's going on. And we hope to be able to grow our community presence with that. And we hope to be able to provide and offer services that are more than just criminal in the future. I think that's in the immediate future and the success that we hope to expound on by offering this service, the services that we have.
Thanks. We're just going to take a quick break. You're listening to WTL New Orleans on 91.5 FM. New Orleans Legal Assistance offers legal aid to low-income area residents. There are different contact numbers for different local areas. Numbers for your area are available by calling 504-865-5885 or visiting the Legal Assistance Group's website, NOLAC.org. Okay, so I guess kind of on that public services announcement a little bit, there are quite a few other groups, I guess, trying to do similar things, you know, provide legal assistance of different types. And I guess I'm just curious overall, I mean, in working with the system, and you spoke a little bit about the frustrations that you had. Can you speak more about them? Like, I mean, what are your hopes, I guess, for the system in the future, or how could it work better or work for everyone in the community?
Well, I guess I'll go first. I think some of my experiences and some of my hopes is that we start to get it. In terms as it relates to juvenile justice and also, you know, adult criminal justice system, we cannot continue and keep on incarcerating and locking up the amount of people that we have been doing. It just doesn't work. It has not been a deterrent to crime. It has impacted, and our communities have suffered because of it immensely. Because not only the person or individual is locked up and incarcerated, and not only did some bad act probably happen to, you know, to the victim or the complainant out there, you have family that's missing their loved one, their individual, that's not in the home anymore, that's not generating resources, that's not passing on knowledge and skill sets on to maybe some of the younger members of the family or the children. You know, you could think about somebody that was a carpenter or a welder, and you know, here in New Orleans, we have a rich history of being skilled craftsmen as well as being musicians. You know, you might be building a house in the daytime, and you might be blowing the horn at night here in New Orleans. Well, if you know that, you know, members of the family are missing out of your household, all of that historical knowledge and legacy and skill set is not being passed down, and so our communities have been immensely impacted and are suffering from the conditions of our current criminal justice system. We cannot continue to look at locking up individuals as being a road to capital gain. We have to be involved in the process of trying to figure out how do we heal our communities, how do we heal our people that are coming home out of the prison system. How do we as a community make it safer and productive and all those things for us to exist. So I'm hoping that we get out of the mass incarceration business. I would love to see, you know, at least, you know, juveniles at 17 years old be still treated as juveniles at 17 years old. There's a system going on now. I believe Illinois has just reversed that. They had it at 17, and now they have moved the age up to 18 to be considered an adult for the legal system. So we're seeing kind of a reversal now of some of the policies and practices that started coming down in the 1990s, and I'm hoping that that trend continues. Being unconstitutional, you know, to lock up a juvenile with life without parole. So I hope we continue in that direction.
I would extend that to for 14, 15, and 16-year-olds, if that's why, if these are the people that the juvenile justice system was created for, then why the exceptions ever to moving kids to adult court? So I would extend just what you were saying about 17-year-olds down further. This is broader, I think, but just where my mind goes when you talk about system change, I think particularly when I'm asked about kids and young people, and, you know, what would be best for them right now, I think it's, I just zoom back to, you know, just a respect for the communities that those people come from and for the parents of kids on a broader level. And also what comes to mind is the privatization that's been happening in schools and in housing and prisons. I think that's all pretty connected, and I think that a lot of particularly young people, just because that's where my background is mostly, are finding themselves locked out of everywhere. And I think that those, maybe some sort of reversal of those recent reforms, won't solve everything, but I think is a sort of reform that's hitting kids and young people from every direction right now and is making things worse, leading more kids to jail.
Yeah, I would echo that, and I would definitely we want to see the decrease of school-based offenses. You know, right now, juveniles, children that are in school, they're being charged with offenses and having to go through the juvenile court system for things that when we were school-age children, we would have gotten detention for. So, you know, regular fist fights, you know, fist fights that didn't involve any weapons or anything like that. You know, the NOPD is being called, you know, the children are being arrested and they're going through the juvenile court system. When that happens, you can automatically be recommended for expulsion if you've gotten arrested from out of the school. And we're starting to see our children, our young men and women being pushed and forced out of the school system. They'll go to an alternative school, and once you get kicked out of an alternative school here in New Orleans, there is no other option for you to go to school to. Even though you're legally mandated to be in school until you're 16 years old, if you got kicked out of your regular school and you got kicked out of the alternative school, then it's, you know, good luck.
It's a mandate, but no right.
Exactly. So, you know, we saw that on an increase when we were in the juvenile defender's office, the amount of school-based offenses that were happening.
Which we know is linked to privatization, I would say.
Yeah, and you know, and that goes into a whole other thing with the charter school system here in New Orleans and things like that. But it's still, you know, some of the reform traction has even happened just because of the financial burden that's been placed on it. Just like most people know, it's more expensive to lock up someone for a year than to pay for somebody's college tuition for a year. Even here at Tulane, maybe. So I mean, it's a heavy burden financially. The social impact is just severe at this point, to where we can't just turn a blind eye to what's going on within our communities, within our neighborhoods, and with our justice system. You know, if we're really talking about equal, adequate access to representation, or if we're really talking about you know, does somebody get a fair chance in court? You know, the you know, on the side of the prosecution, you have the district attorney's office, NOPD officers, district attorney investigators, and the public defender's office. They're supposed to be your equal representation. You have you get assigned an attorney and an investigator, and that's it. Now, I don't know if that's equal to you. A lot of people don't think about it until they get faced with having a criminal proceeding or get charged with something, you know, a crime that they didn't commit. And then you see how unequal a lot of times our justice system really is. But you don't know until it happens to you. then you really find out, or you hear stories from folks and things like that. So we're hoping to see that our justice system change and get better, even in some of these schools, maybe some restorative justice practices instead of just calling law enforcement officers for these little smaller minor school infractions, that it be dealt with, in-house, because we don't want to see cases where, and this actually happened to us before. There was a child a cold drink was taken from out of his hand, and the teacher went to throw it in the trash, and the student came up and ran and grabbed the cold drink back out of the teacher's hand, and that child was charged with battery on a school teacher, which is a very serious offense, and things like that, it just shouldn't warrant becoming a court case and having a child enter into the juvenile justice system and potentially setting them up, for failure into the adult system. So we have to figure out our own senses of justice that we had just a few decades, ago. We treated these type of situations differently, and there is treatment. And the last thing that I want to say that I hope changes is the disparity in the communities of justice. And when I say that, you could have two young children here in the city, Say Jimmy is 15 years old and he goes to Benjamin Franklin High School. And then you had Jamal, who was going to John Mack. That's also 15 years old. Well, there sometimes can be two different worlds of justice that happen here. So little Jimmy goes into Benjamin Franklin High School and gets caught with a bag of marijuana on him. Oftentimes, there's interventions that are called. Jimmy's parents are called. They're trying to figure out, what's going on with little Jimmy? Why is he needing to self-medicate or something like that? What can we do to stop young Jimmy from going down this path? Whereas young Jamal steps into John Mack and gets caught with that same $5 bag of marijuana, and NOPD is automatically called. NOPD makes arrest, that juvenile is processed, booked, and then now is entered into the juvenile justice system, has a court hearing and a potential trial on the way. Well, what we're saying is before you can do all of that to Jamal, why don't you offer the same services that you offered to Jimmy at Benjamin Franklin High School? How come we have two different systems of justice here that exist in the city for our same citizens, for our same children? That shouldn't exist.
I would just add also that there are a number of teachers and educational professionals who are doing restorative justice and who are trying to, would be sitting here next to us. I think it's the larger trend in reforms that are, in my mind, causing the increased likelihood of those strange stories that Miguel was talking about with the Coke can. And
Could you talk a little bit more about that? What do you mean by that?
About what I just said?
Yeah, just the How does it tie into privatization to you?
Yeah, I think there's with the educational reforms that have been happening recently, they've happened really fast for one thing, and there's brand new, I guess, discipline systems and teachers who are sort of starting from scratch when it comes to discipline and new codes and. Yeah, the newness of it and the big changes with the old teachers being gone and a lot of new teachers coming in and, really a lot of people trying to do their best, but just weird things happening with kids being punished and weird conflicts, I think, increased conflict between kids and teachers. Yeah. Maybe not increased, but a different kind.
Well, I mean, I've lost count, but I think we have at least 50 or more different charter schools operating here in New Orleans now. So with their own, it's almost like 50 different little mini school districts that exist and are operating, around the city. So as everybody knows, we had to rebuild our institutions after Katrina. And, I think New Orleans was used as an experiment. For the charter school system, they had a blank slate after Katrina to try to go in and recreate institutions that we once held dear. People don't think when you close down a public school, it was more than just a place that children came and got educated at.
Right.
It was a meeting grounds for the community. It was where oftentimes neighborhoods came and figured out solutions to problems together. It's where, you know, you have very big traditions of band and music and things like this. I mean, there's some musical notes that are passed down orally and they haven't even been committed to paper. Things like that, you know, those were really institutions of the community that was there to educate the children there and also serve the community. And now what I think we have is a charter school system that was experimentation, and now we're seeing that experimentation expand throughout the country right now. And we were kind of the guinea pigs for it, to see what does it look like to have a quasi corporate nonprofit, but we're taking tax dollars and paying for this kind of private entity over here to exist. Supposedly it's not for profit, but you know, tax dollars are being used to pay for it, and our public school system has been gutted, and you know, there's problems that arise over that. There are some good people in the positions in these charter schools though that are trying to figure this out, that are trying to do right by the community, that are trying to do right by the children and hold to the mission of trying to deliver an adequate education to the children here in New Orleans that's been missing, quite frankly, not just after Katrina, but before Katrina too. All these problems didn't just creep up after right. Katrina. Some of these things have historical legacies to them. And you know, if you really want to talk and go all the way back, you know, New Orleans was the biggest slave port in America. So it's not a coincidence that we lock up more people than anywhere else in the world, because you know, slavery supposedly was outlawed everywhere except, you know, if you've been a convicted felon, then you get to be enslaved. Well, we know how to do that here in Louisiana for sure. So
I think another way that plays out, those sort of weird charges coming out of schools. I spent a lot of time on the ground in schools, since that's where a lot of charges were coming from, starting in 2010, when it was even earlier on in this process. And so just being on the ground in schools every day, you know, I would go to a school and the first half of the year it would be named something, and I would go the second half of the year and it would be named something else. So there'd be a number of schools on different floors, and there'd be a sign at the front of the school that said, report to this office, and I'd go to that office and it wouldn't exist. There was just so much was in flux. And just very little accountability within schools and within a building that houses more than one school. Getting pointed in a bunch of different directions, people not having known a kid for very long, or, you know, kids getting bounced around to different schools, schools being really far away from homes, all that kind of stuff. It was a pretty visible way to see how things were in flux and to see how that was affecting kids and people not remembering who called the police or who would have been in the position in the school to have the authority to call the police when an offense happened a month before. I found that a lot. Or the principal wouldn't be there anymore. The witness would have moved to a different charter school, or would have moved to a charter school in New York. Or, that's a little bit more.
Yeah. Well, I wish we had another hour. It's fascinating, really. And I really appreciate you guys coming and a lot of the connections that you made. So we've been speaking to the Louisiana Defenders Collective. You can find all of their information at louisianadefenders.wordpress.com, and their number is 504-645-0796. I want to just thank you guys so much for coming out this morning.
Thank you so much for having us, and we want to thank everybody that tuned in to WTUL to listen to News and Views, for listening to us. Again, if you need legal representation, Louisiana Defenders Collective, 504-645-0796. You can email us at louisianadefenders@riseup.net. And we're here. We uptown, downtown, around town, and back of town.